we might interpret the Bible if we were putting ourselves in the shoes of those who are not in the elite of the world, but in the oppressed of the world, the poor of the world, the deprived of the world, that vast percentage of the world that simply does not even get to read, or if they do read, have virtually no power, or very little power, in the interpretation of Scripture and the determination of doctrine for the church or for any particular religion, for that matter. So, we talked about that briefly, and I don't know how people felt about it. We used the example of Hagar as one example of how you might see or hear the text somewhat differently if you were willing to be in the position of the person who was a maid, a slave, someone at the bottom of society. Are there any comments or questions that people have left over from that exercise? Remembering, of course, that I can never be poor. I can never be hungry. I might voluntarily do it, but I never really will be, because I will always have access to friends, to people, to possibilities. I'm never going to be one of that bottom 70% of the world. My education puts me beyond it, and I can't get out of my education. And they can't get out of their poverty in many cases. But the exercise, I think, is worthwhile because it sensitizes us to the fact that we have all but to unconsciously been reading the Bible from a particular perspective, from our own stance, our own social context, and our social condition. And I think it's important to try and be sensitive to other views. Now, are there any questions or feedback or comments or concerns that people had from yesterday that we may not have covered, that you've been stewing about all the night, saying that Havel guy has caused more problems than he's worth, which is not unusual. Are there any concerns that people have? Okay, what I'd like to do today is to move on to another concern, which is directly related, and that is to look at what I would call master stories. There's nothing sexist in that term. In fact, it might be a very useful way of saying it. These are master stories. And the term is used by a number of people who are studying the function of story. Master stories are those large stories which we have learnt from the very beginning in our culture and have conditioned us to think and operate and read in a certain way. These governing stories operate much the same way that in tribal societies myths operate. They are governing principles that we, as it were, learn from and through those stories. And the stories I'm concerned about are stories about great heroes and heroines. These heroes and heroines who, in fact, we learned about in Sunday school, but in Sunday school, of course, they were very specifically filtered. They were limited. I'm not saying that that's wrong. I think when you're little, you need heroes and heroines as part of the ideals of your hope and your aspirations. But much of the time, our understanding of these heroes and heroines has not gone beyond our Sunday school understanding of them. Now, for most of us, these stories are stories like Adam and Eve. We've all have our understanding of that, which is usually very limited. What are some of the other great master stories which we have lived with all of our life and keep coming up in allusions and other places because there's an understanding amongst all of us that really this is what that particular story's pivotal idea or ideal happens to be?
Cain and Abel.
Right, Cain and Abel is another one.
Noah,
yes, of course. Noah is very, very common and is a classic model story.
David and Goliath.
Yes, very good. David and Goliath. And our image of David is very much dependent upon the fact that we never did side with Goliath, did we? I mean, it's not that easy to be a big guy. And nobody likes a guy who is that abnormally large. Have you ever met somebody who is 7 foot, 8 foot? 7 foot? Yeah, you do, but you know, you feel uncomfortable. Nobody ever sided with Goliath that I can ever remember, but the sister point is that
Joe, if he's on the Lakers, Norm.
Huh? That may be. Yeah, that may be. There are a few basketballers. But I don't remember that there's any of them called the Goliaths. They're things like Lakers. All right.
David and Absalom.
Yeah, David and Absalom. Another one of these great. By the way, the term of the... This is quite aside, and this reminds me of... I once did a study of the term friend in the Bible, because I was concerned about this great classic passage in Job chapter 6 about friends. And you know, there are very, very few people, very few examples of friendship in the whole Old Testament. Very few people, examples of friendship. It's almost invariably a master, servant, or some other relationship. But you name other than David and
Ruth and
Jonathan. Ruth and Naomi are not friends. It's a very different relationship.
It's interesting in the passages that you guys read, though, that one of Nathan's sons was a friend to King Solomon.
Yeah, but that's a technical term. It's nothing to do. That's a use of the term which is like a counselor, intimate counselor. And therefore, the term has a particular connotation, and it's used within the administrative structure of Solomon's empire. But that it's used there, but very, very rare. But David, Absalom you mentioned, but David and Jonathan is the one very classic case. And we keep citing it, but you can find me another one. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Now, that's quite a side. Some other examples, just pretty quickly.
Samson, Delilah.
Yeah, Samson and Delilah. Now that one, which side are you on? I mean, it's difficult to be on either side if you really know the story. And the stories about Samson are absolutely superb. Brilliant writing, brilliant story. And you could go on with these examples of model stories that we have lived with, and we have, if you were to say, well, what's the basic image you have of David over against Goliath?
Good versus evil.
Good versus evil. The little guy who makes it big against the big guy who's bad. You know, typical American Western. And it's similar that we have these kind of images, and they get sort of absorbed into our culture, and we very, very difficult for us to change them. Now, we could go on with a lot more examples of this, and they are really fascinating because we are conditioned by these, whether we like it or not. So to uncondition is very difficult. What I'd like to do is to take one of these, and it's the figure of Solomon. Now, just off the top of your head, without trying to cogitate, what are the things you associate with Solomon?
Wisdom,
he's wise.
Wealth.
Wives, right?
Three W's, wisdom, wealth, and wives.
Yes, wisdom, wealth, and wives. What else? Temple, the building of the temple, right? So therefore a certain measure of piety, because he's, you know, in that sense he's ideal. He's rich, and he's wise, and he builds a temple. What more could you ask? I mean, he's got all the marks of success.
Son of Bathsheba.
Well, son of Bathsheba, which tends to be forgotten. You hear the story of David and Bathsheba is big, but you tend to forget that the kid, well, the first kid was not Solomon. The first kid died. The second one was Solomon, after he went to console him.
Think of his strength, though.
His strength.
Power.
Power, yes. Yeah. Power.
Degeneracy.
Well, we don't usually, a popular image of him is not as a degenerate. Although we'll come to that.
You think of his praying for wisdom.
Yes, right. This great story about him praying for wisdom and God saying, because you asked for wisdom and not wealth, I'll give you both. Right, yeah? How many of you have asked for wisdom and got the wealth? One of those models that we have up there. doesn't always click, does it? So you can't just press that the wisdom button any longer.
Queen of Sheba.
Ah, yes. That's right. Not only women, but the woman, right?
Dividing the children.
Right, we'll come back to that story. And the classic story about dividing the two babies. But we have this image of a very ideal, successful king who is at the same time rebuilds the temple. Everything is an image of perfect success. And I think that's what we're conditioned to. And that's why I would like us to read the story again and read it as if not that we were hoping we would be like him, but as if we were one of his citizens, one of his people. One of the people of that particular community. And what happened? Now, there are a fairly large number of chapters here, so I'm not going to pick up on everything, but select some of them. Are there any questions at this point about, very briefly, what we're doing? It's another simple exercise in trying to read the text from another perspective, trying to see what it would be like. Now, we have to remember that the writer of this text, if he's going to present Solomon, is going to present Solomon generally in a favorable light. But he's not one of those people who whitewashes Solomon. That's the important thing. While he presents him in a favorable light, generally he doesn't whitewash him. And he leaves enough of the seams for you to see what's going on politically and historically in reality. And it's not just a glorification of Solomon, although that is probably there as well. All right, let's take the... I'm just going to talk about chapter 1 and not read it because it's very long. Solomon, who was the one who should have been king? His elder brother, Adonijah. Adonijah should have been king. But because Bathsheba, being who she was, something of a scheming lady, she managed to get Solomon to be made king. He was the youngest. He didn't have the right, but nevertheless he made it. So we won't say too much about that. That's fair enough. That often happens. The younger son gets it over the older son. Well, what is important is what happens in chapter 2. When Solomon finally is made king and David's about to die, David says to him, now, if you're smart, kid, you've got to do certain things if you're going to make sure your kingdom is established. You need to do certain things to establish your kingdom so that you really are king of Israel and not always at the mercy of your enemies. And what does a typical king do who's got enemies or when they come to the throne? Exactly what Solomon did. Knock off, murder the primary opposition. Shimei, Joab, Adonijah murdered the lot. And then it says his kingdom was established. So it's not said anything anywhere that it was good or bad. It's simply stated there that the way it happens when you want to be king that is powerful and really have control is to kill your opposition. Now, there are various excuses for doing it, but still, that's what happened. And having done that, the writer says, he established his kingdom. Don't tell me he's naive before he goes to ask for wisdom. He's already murdered a bunch of people to make sure he's king. So right from the outset, you've got a powerful style of operation, which is of the one who is in power and is going to make sure and guarantee that he controls his empire.
Could you take just a minute, Norman, and explain with his elder brother, Abijah? I can never...
Adonijah.
How he... What's the dynamic that was there about he wanted to marry the nurse or mistress of his...
Yeah, there's a dynamic in there in which, if I understand it correctly, uh-huh. And again, I will give and take on this particular point, but my understanding is that this lady, Abishag, who was a beautiful nubile maiden, mm-hmm. You remember dear old David was so old and chilly and had some kind of fever as an old man that they said, we'll try and warm him up by having this beautiful nubile maiden sleep beside him. It didn't work. But she got status as a result of that. in some extent, she was equivalent to, in a kind of secondary way, the wife of David. You know, she got some kind of status. And by him asking for her, it was like asking for something that really belonged to the king. And this was part of the king's. And Solomon should have rightfully inherited this woman. And earlier, one of the sons, you remember, had gone up to the concubines of David up on the top of the household as a statement of claiming that the wives were his and therefore he was king. So it's related to those kind of claims.
But so that became an excuse to
him. It's an excuse, yes.
Yeah,
he could have said, sorry, she's mine. But it was an excuse and it became a vehicle. He had to have some excuse, but it was a very piddling one. All right, so the kingdom is established and through this particular means. And it's only after that, at the end of chapter 2, that you get this story that everybody knows about, where he decides that he's going to go and have a sacrifice at Gibeon. Now he has a huge sacrifice. Solomon never does anything in half measures. Kills thousands of bulls. And a lot of wasted bull there. And he takes them all up and sacrifices them at Gibeon in chapter 3. And that's fair enough. And he gives a great display of worship and a faithfulness to his God. And God seems to be rather impressed with this. But God's impression is always covered by making it very clear that he will only get what he asks for under certain conditions. Now, if you read this story very carefully, there are a number of very interesting things about it. How Solomon operates. Let's go to verse 7, chapter 3. Oh, I should talk about verse 1 first of all. 3 verse 1. Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Solomon never went to war, really. He did all of his work by marrying off some king's wife, or I mean, two king's daughter. And various ways he managed to make peace with everybody, and never actually did all the fighting. David did all the fighting. Then if you go to verse 7, he has this dream, and in the dream, God asks him, whatever you want, please ask and I will give it to you. And in verse 7, Solomon says, "Now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king in place of David my father, even though I am a little boy. I do not know how to go out or come in." Now, if anybody is understating the case, he just murdered 4 or 5 people, established a kingdom. This is typical rhetoric of somebody who is stating he is humble and insignificant and all the rest of it. Certain measure of irony and tongue-in-cheek in the way the writer puts this. There's no way he's a child. There's no way that he's innocent. He sure knows his way to come in and go out and run in the kingdom. Nevertheless, he states it that way. And so he asks for wisdom. Why does he ask for wisdom? In verse 9. Why does he ask for wisdom? So that he will know lots of things? So that he will be able to be just. He asks for wisdom. Why? We got a problem, these people. I got to know how to rule them. He wants wisdom to be able to control Israel. Power. Wisdom for power. And while some of it is couched in certain terms which suggest otherwise, it is very clear that I need to be able to govern this, quote, great people. But it's very clear also elsewhere that he sees his people as people that have to be brought under control. Otherwise, they will not be properly controlled. Now, God says to him, all right, because you've asked for wisdom, I will give you wealth and all these others. Very nice that you asked for wisdom. But it's also conditional on the fact that he would follow in the steps of David and the law of Moses and so on and so on. It was always conditional. Now, it's interesting that he asks for this kind of wisdom to be able to govern. And there's nothing wrong with that. To be able to succeed in ruling Israel. provided it's done with justice. Now, one of the things that I've discovered after reading extensively in the book of Proverbs is that when we talk about the term wisdom, we very often don't quite understand exactly what the biblical term means in many cases. And it doesn't always mean the same thing every time. That's also a problem for us. We'd like to think that every word will always mean the same thing every time you read it, but it doesn't. When you think of wisdom, what do you think of?
Knowledge.
A special kind of knowledge. Some old men have it. Some old women have it.
Understanding.
Some sort insight. Of understanding, insight.
Discernment.
You can see through things.
Horse sense.
Now, Solomon had horse sense. Foresight. A whole series of very subtle things. But when you read the first part of Proverbs, especially chapters 1 to 9, you discover that wisdom is some of those things, but more importantly, wisdom is the capacity to succeed in life. The capacity to win. Capacity to overcome, the capacity to succeed as an artist all the way to being a king. And in chapter 8 there's this big thing about kings rule by wisdom. That is the kind of capacity to govern, to control a lot of things, to be an Iacocca. So wisdom is often that, and it's not quite as much what we often think it is. In other places, of course, it has that sense, but in many places it means a capacity to succeed. So when Solomon is saying, I want wisdom, he is really saying, I want this capacity to be able to govern this whole people and do it so that I'm the biggest and the best in town. And of course, our image of Solomon as a success is in fact related to the fact that he does have wisdom, which is the capacity to succeed in these texts. Now, there was a hope, however, that he would not only have wisdom as wisdom for power, which is the one side of the coin, and this is the polarity. There was also wisdom for power or success, we'll say, over against wisdom for justice. Now there's a story told, which every one of us knows, which would suggest that this is what we remember Solomon for. When in fact, what we've seen already is that he's praying for wisdom to succeed as a ruler with power. Two different focuses. Let's take that story. It's a story about two women who have two babies. You remember? Very common story. Who were the two women, by the way? Well, yeah, prostitutes. There were two prostitutes. Bottom of society, nobodies. And of course, it is very important that if a king is going to be able to demonstrate justice in a public way, he's got to be able to do it right across the gamut of society. So in this, he is playing a typical role of people of the ancient, kings of the ancient world. And so he has these two women come, and they present their babies, and you know the story very well. The one says, it's mine, the other says, it's mine. And Solomon makes a decision. He says, all right, we'll cut the baby in half. You have half, and you have half. And the one whose child is not says, great idea. The one whose child it is says, no, let the other one have it. And of course, the woman who wanted the child to live is the one whose real mother it was. Now, the story is important not just because of the story, but because of the last few lines. Verse 28. And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king because they perceived what? The wisdom of God was in him to render justice. Now that was the hope of the people. This was the aspiration of Solomon. And the question is, in the end, of course, who wins? The only story in the whole of Solomon that suggests he has wisdom for justice is this one. All the other stories talk of that wisdom for success and power. And the other striking thing is that that story about the two women you can find all over the world. It's a story adopted to, at least I would suggest. Now, it may have been an original story with Solomon, but you can find it in India, you can find it in Africa, you can find it a very, very common story. And the point of the story, though, is to say, if you want a perfect example of wisdom, this is one of the classic stories that circulated the world. Fascinating. And you apply it to the great kings who are declared wise. Now, Solomon, the people had hoped for this, wisdom for justice. And God had said, if you will follow my ways and have justice and righteousness, then you will be on the throne forever, etc., etc. Solomon, however, was going to be and had aspirations to be the greatest king. Now you need to know just a little bit of history. Why Solomon could become so great. It was a point in Israel, in the history of the ancient Near East, where, you remember the map of the ancient Near East, I'm sure. In the, here's Egypt down here, here's Palestine here, and here's the Tigris, Euphrates River over here. And you've got a little territory here called Israel, right? A little high there, but. The Hittites were here, there were Hittite kings up there. There was a Mesopotamia was over here with various rulers, and Egypt was over here. But at that particular point in history, none of these particular empires were very strong. None of the kings were very strong. The king of Egypt would not have married his daughter to Solomon if he had been that big. He would have said, forget it, you puny. And similarly over here. But this was a point where Solomon, because of the circumstances, was able to spread his empire and his rule quite a ways in both directions. And the possibility of being great was there, as well as, of course, the aspiration. And so that needs to be kept in mind as you read what follows. Then comes chapter 4. Questions to this point about the picture so far. And this problem that is posed between the hope of wisdom for justice and the aspiration for wisdom for success and power. Okay? Now, chapter 4, the first six verses I won't read, but the first six verses are important because they do illustrate that Solomon was a brilliant administrator. He organized that empire in a very classical way, which set up officers and armies and priests. Everybody had somebody under control who was under his control. I mean, there was nothing that was out of his control. Very, very carefully organized. Brilliant. Success. Then comes verse 7. Solomon had 12 officers over all of Israel who had just one job, to feed him, to provide food for the king and his household. So he had organized the food resources. But he organized the food resources so that a large portion of the food resources of the whole country came to him. And then you turn over to verse 22. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 kor of fine flour and 60 kor of meal and 10 fat oxen and 20 pasture-fed cattle and 100 sheep besides house gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. Now, if anybody can eat that much in one day, I'll, you know. The whole point, however, whether it's an exaggerated picture or not, is that Solomon had an on whole scheme to be able to make sure that he had a great lavish feast of food provided for his temple, rather his palace rather, every day. Now if you take that much of the resources of the country, you've either got to be building a lot more stuff, or somebody's going to be suffering. It's just inevitable. But the picture of him as a very rich and lavish man, an extravagant man, is extremely strong. Now, you might say, well, that's the way a king is, but.
Can I hold this for you?
Are there any questions about that? It really presents an extraordinary picture of extravagance. And a little further down, verse 26, Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 20,000 horsemen. Now, Solomon never went to war. These were all part of the great entourage and also part of what was a major part of his activity, and that is Solomon was a horse trader. I mean, in many ways, that's a good term for it. Because he would, the Hittites in the north would provide horses, and he would mediate and fatten them and breed them and so on, and then he would sell them to the Egyptians. So he built a whole trade in horses, as well as other trades in boats and ships and 1,001 other things. Solomon's greatness was also that he set up the first really powerful trade exchange in that part of the world. Now, all of that may seem to be just plain smart, but if you're using all those resources largely for your own glorification rather than for the advancement of your people, then there's a problem. Now, strange to say, if you read back in verse 20 of chapter 4, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand of the sea, and they ate and they drank and they were happy. Well, that statement is a statement of the writer which is like any political annals, says what you want to say. But as you read later on and you see what the people did go through and what happened as soon as he died, you know that they were not really happy. And that's one of the problems. The writers will be writing to some extent in such a way that it sounds good when in fact a lot more is going on that isn't. Well, if Solomon was happy, sure. But what about the rest? Now, in chapter 5, the time comes for Solomon to build the temple. And that, we might say, that's fantastic. Why shouldn't he build a temple? There should be a temple to Yahweh. But he decided he was going to build the biggest and best and most beautiful temple there was in the world. There's a certain Texan attitude for it. Now, he sent his servants to Tyre, Hiram, king of Tyre, because they needed to have the very best timber. And the best timber was? The cedars of Lebanon. Now, the cedars of Lebanon are up in Lebanon, up in Tyre, up a little further north of Israel. And it was necessary to get the cedar wood from there down to Jerusalem. So how did they do it? They cut the trees from up in the mountains, which are right up high like this, then took them overland to the shore, and they floated them down the Mediterranean, and then across land to Jerusalem. Now to do that, you need quite an army of people. And so he said at breakfast one morning, who's willing to go? But there weren't any volunteers, of course. And necessarily, therefore, the way in which the temple was built was with slave labor. So he had large numbers of people who were forced into service. Verse 13. And King Solomon raised a levy of forced labor out of all of Israel, and the levy numbered 30,000. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 in a month in relays. He didn't want to knock them out absolutely. So they went in relays of 1,000 and various other groups of people that were used to cut the stone, haul the logs, etc. It was a huge operation. But the only way you could do that was with slave labor. So just like the building of the pyramids in Egypt, the same technique of mass labor is needed if you're going to do this kind of building for the Temple of Jerusalem. Questions? There's a lot of highly skilled and brilliant organization went into this. But somebody has to suffer if you're going to have a magnificent temple. Can you take any one of the great temples of the world, in India, or the great temples of Egypt, they had to be built with this kind of mass labor. Otherwise, it couldn't be done.
I was confused. Later on, it says that these were not Israelites, that none of them were slaves. Is that...
The later passage, this passage makes it clear that they are Israelites.
Yeah.
They were Israelites. Later on, the kind of continuous and perpetual slaves that he uses, it argues, were Hittites and non-Israelites. And that's a sort of way to soften it. Well, the people of Israel didn't really become permanent slaves, but we did have these others who were permanent slaves. If you were a foreigner in town, and you weren't a true son of Abraham, we could make you a permanent slave. That's perfectly all right.
At that time, would being a soldier be tantamount to being a slave?
Well, the soldier sometimes had a slightly better lot than some of the other slaves. But if you were a forced laborer to do this, you had to do all the work. And he would also force them into work in the stalls of the horses. Those were forced labor. And jobs connected with the temple. All sorts of other things were forced labor. It wasn't just soldiers. There's all sorts of labor projects as well were forced labor. Now, if you go back to the days of Samuel, Samuel had said to the people of Israel, if you choose a king, this is what's going to happen. In Samuel 8, he makes it very clear that if you were to choose a king, he will take your manservants and your maidservants and your daughters and your sons, and he will use them to be his cooks and his confectioners and his butchers and everything else. And of course, that's exactly what does happen. What Solomon predicted came true. Now, it is true later on they try to argue, but still doesn't condone it as far as I'm concerned, whether they were Israelites or not. In fact, that's a later kind of perspective, because under David, there was a really very early intermarriage between these Canaanites and Israelites, and who can tell who was what? That's a kind of pious picture of a later period. Okay, any more questions about that? Yes?
Was there supposed to be some sort of glory that one achieved by being part of this big operation?
Yeah. If you are going to be a true emperor, right? If you're going to be a Maharaja in India, there's certain things that go along with it. And you've got to have a magnificent palace, you've got to have all sorts of things that are associated with it. 155 elephants or whatever it is. So there are certain things that go along with being a true emperor or ruler in the ancient world. One was a large harem. We haven't talked about. The other one was a large palace. The other one was a temple attached to the palace, which is the royal palace, as it were, the king's palace, the king's temple, rather. And the other one was some kind of, by this time, some kind of educational system. So that when it talks about the wisdom of Solomon, don't think that means that he sat down and did all this. It means that there had developed something like an entourage of priests and scribes and wise men who were part and parcel of this group of people called the temple palace household. And the palace household, you see, has these people in it, and probably the first part of the book of Proverbs, in fact, is a product of the training program for the men of that household. The women were not involved at all. It was indeed men of that household.
But the slave was supposed to get some glory out of being part of that.
I said, baby, no, you just do your duty. If you're a slave, you're a slave, right? There's a kind. Maybe you would get some reflected glory if you were talking to some other slaves, and my king's better than your king.
Yeah.
When would you ever get that chance? I mean, once you are in a forced labor situation, if you are able to accept the reflected glory of your king, fine. But it's very clear that as soon as Solomon dies, we'll come to that. Yeah.
You're lacking one thing here in this empire sort of thing. Don't you need a national guard to sort of hold it together?
Yes, you need an army. I'm sorry, I didn't actually go through. If you look at the beginning of chapter 4, I think it is, you have to have a whole series of things. One is also a big records office. They have a secretary. A whole system of keeping the records of economic records and accounts. You find these old palaces, and they have these clay tablets, which are basically so-and-so sold this piece of land to so-and-so. All these economic, these records. So there's a very elaborate recording system, both in ancient Egypt and in ancient India, we found them, and in ancient Israel, and so on.
Is there much implication in there, though, about that there was a need for a National Guard, or that, you know, that there's an underlying current that, you know, that you had to keep the lid on things, the people
had to pay
for all this.
And the people had to pay for that, right. And that part of the problem later on was that Jeroboam wants to rebel, and so he puts him in charge of something. So this process of keeping some kind of an army, the king's army, was the army that was kept to make sure that everything in all the territories was controlled. And of course, Solomon was expanding, and these territories beyond, the Edom and all these other territories outside, we talked about yesterday in the Abraham story, those peoples that are lesser people in the stories of the patriarchs are under the control now of Solomon's empire. And those territories, outlying territories, especially needed some kind of military presence. It's not that much different to the situation today. And there's not much difference in terms of trading horses than it is today of trading arms. He's a middleman in a system which will facilitate the war capacity of the peoples that he trades with. So while he's called a king of peace, it's simply because he's a king at a point in time when he has peace in his empire and he's got a great administrative control and he has no real, at this point, great threats at any other point in the areas around it. And he has very carefully set his controlling administrative offices and army personnel at the appropriate places around his empire. That's why it's a peace. He's a brilliant administrator. There's no question about that.
That system of having 12
officials.
That they have to provide for his household for a month. So in order to do that, they have to control a region.
Right.
And that does a great way to control the countryside.
Yeah. And each one of those 12 people who has to have has a month's responsibility for the king, and the other 11 months are for themselves.
That's right.
Right. And of course, in India, I became so aware that if you become one of the government officials, you may only get a small salary, but you get a huge kickback. An unbelievable amount of corruption. That if every turn, if somebody wants to get something from the administrative official, whoever it is, whatever level, you pay some sort of bribe. There's some sort of kickback. And the expectation was that when I was principal of the international school there, that I was somehow or another getting all kinds of extra perks. It was just assumed. And I said, no, we are not going to take a bribe for this. We're not going to pay a bribe. I won't accept any money. Your kids come into the school because they are capable, not because you pay me $500,000 or whatever you want to pay me. And that's an amazing thing, that in certain systems, if you're in power, you're expected. And of course, that happens in this society, but much more subtly. Yeah?
The one thing in this account that gives me a little bit of a different picture in chapter 4, beginning with verse 29, when it talks about how all nations came to him because of his great wisdom, what it speaks of is his wisdom in writing proverbs and songs and in teaching about the birds and animals and the trees, like he was a real botanist and biologist.
Yeah.
But would that just be part of the image of being
right,
the greatest wise man?
Right. You have to understand that, as I said, part of the court has a number of these things. It has the administrative center, it has the religious center, but it also has this educational center. And part of that is to build a kind of library, with the collection of wisdom. You have such collections in ancient Egypt and other parts of the world, well, primarily in Egypt. But these collections of wisdom, of wise sayings, were used, it seems, according to the book of Proverbs, as part of the education process. If you're going to train people to be your officials and diplomats and ambassadors and the king's sons and so on, you need to have guidance. And so these proverb sayings were very much part of the educational system. There was folk proverbs too, but there were also these that what might be called royal proverbs, which are part of the educational process. So I wouldn't think of him actually as sitting down writing, because, you know, this morning I'm going to write about the bees kind of thing. Solomon was very much a collector and an administrator and a trader. So he's trading in proverbs as much as he's trading in people and trading in products.
Certainly one of the ways that England ruled the Commonwealth was through the educational system. Everybody was sent back to England and educated there,
yeah,
and then
right,
sent back.
Yeah. That's right. Education was part of an empire in ancient, a good empire. There are empires that fell apart, like Akhenaten, who was so obsessed with religion that he didn't worry about the other things. But if you kept all of these in balance, both the religious and the economic and the military and the educational, interesting that education was already there, then you've got a much more balanced empire. Even if it is oppressive and even if half of the people are slaves, it's still going on. Okay, any other questions? Now, let's turn to the past. We're not going to deal with the building of the temple. We'll turn over to chapter 9, if you will, and take a look at story of chapter 9, which gives you another picture of just exactly where we are. Once again, God promises him, if you, Jehovah Solomon, now that you've built the temple, I admit that it's a very fine thing to do, but unless you follow in the ways of the Lord, you will lose your empire. And of course, that's eventually what happened. But if you go to some of these texts, it repeats a lot more of the things that Solomon does. Let's take verse 15. And this is the account of the forced labor which King Solomon levied to build the house of the Lord and his own house, and the Millo and the wall of Jerusalem and Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer. Don't tell me it was just one building. He built all these big cities, and all of them on the basis of forced labor. So the entire empire with all these great cities scattered around it, which were marks of his administrative control, were also built in the same way. And it goes on with all of the different things that he did. One other thing before we forget. Verse 26, and King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea. And this was trade in gold and ivory and all kinds of other things. A very extensive trade from Ezion-Geber, which is down in the Gulf. And there's no question about it actually happened. That's not a debated point. Now, in chapter 10, we have the visit of the Queen of Sheba. Now, we all know that story. And she heard all about his wisdom, which is a way of saying she heard all about his glory. But if you read verse 7, I did not believe the reports which until I came in my own eyes have seen, and behold, the half was not told me, your wisdom and prosperity. Notice how they are linked together. That's almost like we say two words meaning the same thing. They are a united thing. How happy are all of your wives? Happy are those who are your servants, your slaves. How continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Oh, it must be wonderful to be a slave in this king's court. Blessed be the Lord God who has delighted you. She's just pouring it on. Set you on the throne of Israel because the Lord loved Israel forever and he has made you king and you execute righteousness and justice. He just pours it on. Because it's a rhetoric of flattery of what the king is supposed to be and is supposed to hear. And of course none of it, or very little of it, is true. Now, he then says, okay, sweetie, whatever you want, I'll give you. You know all those stories. Now, just to get a picture of all of this, exactly the extravagance, a couple more images of the extravagance. Verse 14. Now, the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. That's a lot of gold. Huge amounts of gold, besides which came from traders and from traffic of merchants, from the kings of Arabia and the governors of the land. They all brought in gold. Everybody brought in gold. King Solomon made 200 large sheets. Shields of beaten gold. What do they need shields of gold for? And fight them. They're all pure decoration. And 600 shekels of gold went to make each shield. And he made 300 shields of beaten gold. And so it goes on and on and on and on. Verse 18. And the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with gold. It keeps going on and on and on. The extravagance of this king is unbelievable. And of course, every time Israel got conquered later on, they got all got ripped off. All the conquerors came and took all of this gold from the temple and everywhere else in the palace and so on. You can go on. Verse 22, the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish with a fleet of Hiram, and there was 3 years the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. There we go. It is an amazing story of great success. But at the same time, it's the portrait of a tyrant who uses all of this for the glorification of his own kingdom and the court, which makes him great. What happens when he dies? Time is running out. He had all these foreign women. What happens when he dies? There is, verse 26, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, a servant of Solomon. Notice he's a slave. He's one of Solomon's slaves. We forget that, but the northern kingdom was founded and ruled by one of Solomon's slaves, servants. And whose mother's name was so-and-so, a widow who also lifted up his hand against the king. Now he was beginning to rebel. He didn't particularly like being a slave of the king. And for this reason why, and this is the reason why he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built the Milo and closed up, and that was all with forced labor, obviously. Because he built all these walls with forced labor. Finally, this one guy, like Moses, said, I've had enough. So Solomon said, well, this guy's pretty bright. What I'll do is I'll make him in charge of all the slaves. So you shut a guy up by giving him this beautiful big plum of being in charge of all the forced labor. So if you're concerned about the forced labor, all right, I'll make you in charge of the forced labor. But you still have to produce. And as a, then the prophet comes along, and you have the story about how he tears the cloth and 12 parts, 2 gold, 10 of those parts are for Ahijah, Jeroboam. And as the story continues, I don't have time to go through it. What happens in the course of time is that a promise is made by God to Jeroboam. Jeroboam, you're a slave. And you often wonder why this was never carried through. Just like the Israelites were slaves, Jeroboam the slave was made the promise. If you, Jeroboam, will be faithful to God, you will always have somebody on the throne. The same promise that was made to David was made to the slave, Jeroboam. We often wonder, because the northern kingdom did eventually disappear, didn't it? 10 tribes. Now, when Solomon heard about that, he kicked him out, Jeroboam fled, and as time came on, as time went on, Solomon dies, and Solomon's son, who's called Rehoboam, not Jeroboam, Rehoboam, Solomon's son Rehoboam, is approached by the people and said, look, we have lived under oppression all the time of Solomon. We have been oppressed by him, enslaved by him. Now, relieve it. So he went to the old men, and the old men says, yes, it's time to let up. The young Rehoboam then went to the young men. The young men says, give it to him. Give it to him. So he said, no, my father's loins were no bigger than my little finger. So he oppressed them more. And as a result, the split happened. And the people of the north followed Jeroboam, the slave, and the people of the south followed the son of the tyrant, Solomon. And strangely, the history of our tradition is that the Israelite heritage has followed through from the line of Solomon instead of the line of Jeroboam. But if we want to really understand it, we need to understand that God had worked with and tried to work with this man, but in spite of God's gift of wisdom, he used the wisdom to oppress his people instead of to liberate. So he is not a figure for liberation and peace. He may have had peace. The Messiah is not called the son of Solomon. Questions? Solomon is therefore someone whom I find very difficult any longer to consider great, other than in the terms of the great political leaders of the world like Reagan, who can trade in anything.
Question?
Yeah. Sorry.
Isn't there, place in the Bible where God tells Solomon specifically not to have foreign wives and to have lots of horses?
He tells him not to have the foreign wives. He tells him not to go and worship other gods. But by marrying foreign wives, as he got older, his wife said, look, if you're going to marry me, you got to marry my God, as it were. Love me, love my God. And so Solomon brought into Jerusalem and into the temple itself and set up separate shrines for the gods of these wives. And so frequently when we talk about the falling aside, when Solomon's great debacle, we think it's because of these wives. But the wives are just a little bit of the picture. Sure, they were part of his great affluence and as a result of that, he had to accommodate them and therefore accommodate these other gods if he's going to be at peace with these other nations whose king's wives he married. Those are the ones. Not the harem. The harems are just they're slaves, the harem. But these are the real wives whose kings, who are the wives of daughters of kings, and who brought with them their gods. And they are, of course, also part of it. And the book of the Bible especially condemns him for that. But what I'm saying is that if you read a little more deeply, you'll realize that the writer has left behind all sorts of clues that his stakes, his corruption, is at a deeper level than simply adultery.
Seems like I don't remember where that is in the Bible. It seems like it talked also about specifically it was not to have all these horses either. I don't remember.
Yeah, well, if you go back, the history of the horses is interesting. When horses were originally, because they were associated with Canaanites and Hittites and those other people, were perceived of as symbols of foreign gods too, associated with foreign gods. And when Joshua came into the battles of Canaan, what did he do whenever he found the horses? No, he hamstrung them. And David also hamstrung horses. So you have a history of the two of great predecessors who have absolutely said nothing, we won't have anything to do with horses because they represent pagans and they represent foreign gods and they don't represent Yahweh. So you've got a history of this, rejecting horses. Solomon, however, reverses that whole thing and takes anything he can from the imagery of the ancient world in order to adopt a kingdom that will be truly great like the other kingdom. In fact, he reverses it so much to the point that he becomes, in fact, the key horse trader between Hittites and the Egyptians. Any other questions?
Yeah. If we were people at the bottom, what's the message? I mean, the
message is that God seems to be on the side of the guy on top. And that if you're going to be reading it for somebody who's on the bottom, you have to read a measure of judgment on it. I was facetious. That there is a measure of judgment. That Solomon is, while he was the one that God had given wisdom, abused it, and the people of God are the ones who are suffering, are the slaves, who eventually survive it all, and Solomon gets his judgment. And virtually every one of the kings that follows on, not followed. See, if you had followed the advice, they had followed the advice of Samuel, they would never have made a king. They would have had a whole different society. Truly egalitarian society. But God seems to have to, and he does it throughout history, accommodate the fact that people want certain things. The king, people say, no, we're going to have a king. And he accommodates that, and he allows for the king, and then he tries to work with the king. God doesn't prevent these movements of history amongst his people. But somehow or another, there are people like Adonijah the prophet. Now, he is really speaking for the people in the middle of that. There are prophets. And from this point on, the people who are speaking for God are prophets like Samuel and... Oh, hold on a minute. Oh, my goodness. Gee. And so.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the real message is that... Not that God's on the side of Solomon,
no,
as much as that he gives him free will, and if the people aren't vigilant, this is what happens.
But of course it's difficult when you've got that much power. Efforts to rebel or somebody like Jeroboam. Yeah. But the point is that God seems to be working with his people in spite of the oppression and all the rest of it, of the rulers. But if you're sitting at the bottom, you must say Solomon was an oppressor. Even God's own people produced oppressors. And the history of Christianity has pretty much been able to vindicate the same thing. And yet somehow God is working in the middle of all of this, and that he's with those slaves. Although we never remember to know their names.
But does God have a political message for the people at the bottom about vigilance?
Yeah.
With regard to rulers.
Yeah.
does he? You know, is he saying be constantly?
Yeah. You see, if you go back to what we come to tomorrow, ask the question tomorrow when we go. We're going to go backwards a little bit. We're going into the Exodus story tomorrow. Was there a political message to the people in Israel who were enslaved in Egypt? When Israel in turn becomes no longer a slave but is itself got power, then it abuses power. And the message clearly is that you have abused power. If you begin to listen to the prophets, you will hear that they have clearly passed a message of judgment on the kings. One after the other, they bring God's wrath down on the king. And Nathan a little earlier had done the same thing with David. So that the message of God, there's always this counter message. You kind of have a political text at the top which says this is what the great kings of Israel are like, but there's also the message underneath it that's going on as well. That God speaks through the prophets and speaks for the people and cries for justice. And the cry for justice is going on in spite of the fact that God's own kings are oppressing. And that people ought to be willing to be prophets. Of course, it's lonely being a prophet. You don't necessarily get a job in the household of the king.